puts all its energy into celebrating life. And once you can see that, then the silence starts to grow. Because it takes you away from the nonsense, from the soap opera. Soap opera stops making any sense. The flower doesn't care whether so-and-so said they were going to get married to so-and-so but didn't, or the so-and-so. I mean, all that. Just nonsense. Those headlines that just hit us and hit us, and none of it matters. None of it matters. This is the one thing that matters. This is the one thing that cannot be taken away from us. Jesus has promised that. Your Dutch lesson for today. One of the reasons I like Dutch, it was my first attempt at a foreign language ever. And I fell in love with Holland the moment I saw it at about the age of 11. At about 5:30, one very cold morning, coming into the Hoek van Holland, which is the port from that we arrived in when I was going on with a choir tour to Europe from England. And one of the reasons I like Dutch, and I hope Nancy doesn't find this offensive, or indeed Jim, offensive. Dutch is just the most unlikely language in the world. It just sounds so unlikely. And I think that's part of its charm.
But
a bit. But even with an unlikely language like Dutch, which is like my pet language, you have things to learn, because whenever you go from one language to another, you broaden your horizons. You're bound to. You have to. Because things that exist in one language can't exist exactly the same in another. And so your experience is widened. And the concept I wanted to share with you this evening on that subject was that of guardian angel. I never liked the term guardian angel very much, because I don't really like the word guardian. It's usually, in England, it was sort of parent or guardian. The person had to sign your forms, you know, for TB shots and stuff. And guardian usually meant, well, it's the person that's there if your mum and dad die. So it's got a sort of a tragic edge to it, this word guardian. It's also the name of a newspaper which is very famous for misprints. So famous that it's usually called the Grawny Ad. Anyway, the Dutch have something to teach us about guardian angels. The expression in Dutch is de schermengel, the shield angel. It's an angel who shields you. So now when you say goodnight to your guardian angel tonight, you'll be able to tell him that's what his job is.
When you were talking about the mind and the heart and silence, what came to my mind is, how does Byzantine music fit into this? How do my tapes that have this beautiful liturgical music, how does that fit in with silence and with the heart and with the mind?
That's an interesting question. The first thing I have to say about Byzantine chant is that it is something of an acquired taste. And not everybody is going to acquire it. I find Gregorian chant easier, and I just wish that the Roman Catholics hadn't sort of got rid of it so quickly. Chant of any form is, as opposed to singing, is a way of manipulating silence. And just as we'll learn tomorrow, the words of the Jesus Prayer, the words take us deeper and deeper into silence, so chant can fulfill the same function. Now, whether this is going to happen every time you hear it, I certainly can't say. And certainly, there are some chanters I've heard. In Patmos, we had some wonderful singers. They weren't very good, but they were wonderful. They were simple people. They knew the tones upside down and inside out. If they ever made a mistake, you'd hear this sort of, around the church. Some of those guys almost lost their teeth when I turned up. So, for reasons best known to ourselves, when it came to major feast days, they would invite one of the married priests who lived on the island, who looked after one of the parishes on the island, to come and sing for us. And he had the most operatic, complicated way of singing Byzantine music. And it went on for hours. And I hated it. And I told them so. So I'm perhaps not the best person to ask. I've always enjoyed Russian chant, some Byzantine chant, not all, and Gregorian chant. And then there are many, what you might want to call folk music traditions throughout the world that have this same function in different religious traditions. And including, oddly, I don't think my Scottish friend is here tonight, but in what they call the Wee Frees in the Highlands of Scotland, these are the churches that found that the Church of Scotland wasn't Calvinist enough and set up on their own. It's the Zwarte Kauser of the islands. It's the real sort of heavy duty Calvinism is a bit thing. Anyway, they developed a form of singing which is quite uncanny. It sounds like cats wailing. And it's sung in Gaelic, the ancient Scottish language. And it's a presenter starts it off, and then the people join in, and they wail, and they wail, and they wail. It's extraordinary sound. If you're not used to it, it's a bit frightening. But that, too, I mean, it is capable of bearing, you know, silence. So, and I'm sure some music can, too. Secular music is able to do that. I mean, there are certain things that I listen to where it's true of anything. Let me broaden this. Sometimes when you're confronted by something very, very beautiful, your mind goes into one of these. That's neepsis. That's this attention thing. And your mind actually stops. And it can be music, it can be a painting, it can be all sorts of things. And that's very wonderful too.
How do you know when you're there, when you've achieved what we've been talking about? How do you know when you're in your heart? Is there some physical thing that happens, or what?
Thank you, and that's a very good question. I would say that arriving is not important. That actually getting there is not important. What is important is going towards there. I don't think we ever arrive. I don't think that... Hush, woman. I don't think there is a point of arriving, unless you say it's the second coming, it's the consummation of the kingdom. It's when everything is, and everything gets its... God is in everything, and everybody gets their real name and all that. Those beautiful images that we get from Scripture and elsewhere. We're always on the way. We're never arriving. And even the greatest, greatest, greatest saint is still, in many respects, simply a beginner. In fact, to lose the capacity for being a beginner is a dangerous and unpleasant thing. We want to be beginners. And whether it's we're beginning on day one or beginning on day 1001, we're still beginners. So we don't arrive. We're working towards something. I can't really answer your question because when I say I'm a beginner, I don't mean that I'm one of those 1001 begins. I mean, I'm right at the beginning. I don't have any sense that any amount of achievement is what you're seeking. Achievement is a mind thing. The heart's already there. The heart is in the kingdom. So it's not a question of moving towards something, just becoming aware that something is already there. So how are you aware? We'll never be perfect at this. I don't think it's possible to be perfect at this. So there will always be room for improvement. So whether it's a little room for improvement or a long, big room for improvement, I think that might change each day. I think we may have different notions. One day we might think, oh, I've achieved a lot today. And then the next day you look back and think, oh, well, yes, but there was this and that, you know, and there's some. It tends to have that effect that when it, if I can go back to the addiction model just very quickly for the moment, when you get rid of one addiction, then you have to, the next thing you have to do is start working on the next one, and the next one, and the next one, and the next one. I mean, you can't, at no point you wash your hands and say, oh, well, I've done that, until you die. And then when you die, I think other rules pertain. I don't think it stops. It just carries on under different conditions. So that's not really a very satisfactory answer, but I think that's what I'd need to say. Is that all right?
Do you get any kind of clue you're getting close?
You know, I don't think we do. I think most people, whether they're proclaimed saints by the church or silently by God himself, I think most of the saints are surprised when they're nominated. Unlike the people that go for the Emmy Awards, you know, or whatever, the Academy Awards. I think most of the saints would be really, really surprised when their name came up. I think we have that to look forward to.
Father Mel, you said that feelings have to do with the mind and not with the heart. Okay, I'm a person who thinks more with my heart than with my mind. And there have been times when I've been really angry about something or at somebody, and I was determined to stay angry. And then suddenly my heart melted. And because my heart melted, I was able to go to that person and make amends and let go of the anger.
It was your mind that melted. It was your mind that melted. Your heart doesn't need to melt, because your heart, as it were, is already perfect. What may have happened, that your mind started listening to your heart. That's nice. But all emotions are felt here. Most of my mind, I have usually felt right here. So you would say, oh, that must be something to do with the heart. And it's not. It's simply the body's reaction to the mind. So now, this is on the definition of what I've been talking in the last 3 days. Another person may talk about it in different ways. But using my, the way I've set it up, then we would need to say that your heart, your mind melted. Behind you, yes.
This is kind of moving a little bit out of maybe what you wanted to include to talk about, but I'm kind of curious now about the mind. You don't mean organically the brain when you're talking about that, do you? In other words, when we reach the intermediate state after we've fallen asleep, do we still have a mind and a heart, and are they still, I mean, what's the deal there?
During sleep?
Is there only the heart when we die?
Oh, when we die?
Yeah.
That's God's stuff. I don't know.
There's no teaching on that? I mean, is there any teaching on whether
the Orthodox Church is... there have been individual saints who have written some things about what happens after death. It is true. But on the whole, the Orthodox Church is very, very reluctant to speculate about anything. And speculation is, by definition, writing about something that cannot be tested. The Orthodox Church just doesn't. Death is as much of mystery as life and as much as birth. So in my own way, I've divided the whole universe into my stuff and God's stuff. And I said, by comparison, my stuff's pretty sort of paltry and not very exciting. Most of it's God's stuff, and I let God do it. I mean, I don't have to do it for him. So the answer is I don't know. I know a bit about what happens in sleep, but sleep and death are connected. Not just linguistically, there is some, obviously there is some deeper connection that Jesus hints at between sleeping and dying, but I don't understand, I don't know, no, I don't know at all. God's stuff.
Sleep, you know, I mean, you...
Oh, the monkey chatter takes over
in
sleep.
Have to give
it
a firm hush, you know, at some point.
Right. I don't know. I'm sorry.
You mentioned briefly something about not praying with icons or idolatry or something. I was out of my mind and I didn't hear it clearly.
I said that if we use our imagination to create a god and then pray to that image, it is an idol. It's a false image. If we're using our imaginations to create God, we have to avoid that. That's why the church gives us icons. That's why the churches which don't use icons are in grave danger of falling into idolatry. This is sort of like Olvens de Bove. It really is sort of complicated. But because we have icons, we have no need to create false icons. Notice also that there is no definitive version of any one icon. The church doesn't say, this is the icon of Jesus Christ, this is the icon of the Mother of God, and all other icons have to conform to these. The church has never said that, and as far as I can see, probably never will. Which means that no matter how good an icon is, it is never the total picture. Because there again, to reduce God to a particular piece of wood would be to create an idol. The fact that that God allows the object, in this case the wood and the paint, to become God-bearing is God's stuff and not ours. That's what God does for us. So we don't need to go through this process of creating false icons, false images, with our imagination. Okay?
You talked about the image of a child and how a child is in response to things around the world and in a sense. And I'm thinking about it. There's a particular story where there's a man that's in a church and he's very contemplative about trying to pray and concentrate very hard. And there's a little child that comes running in and just is going up to all the icons across the whole iconostasis, you know, hello, Jesus, I love you, Lord, you know, and then all of a sudden runs out and is completely gone. And the man is just kind of sitting there going, whoa, what was that? And so is my understanding correct that we are that little child that is trying to develop and yet have that carefree sense of attitude with things of this world, and that we are constantly trying to develop as that child?
Right. Jesus, obviously, in several parts of the gospel, makes it quite plain that he appreciates children. One might say that he's encouraging every one of us to become childlike, not childish, childlike, because children have a spontaneity and an innocence about them which as adults we so quickly lose because of the machinations of the mind. In children, the mind isn't that well developed, and they're like the flower. The celebration of life is still there until life knocks it out of them somewhere along the line. So to become like a child is for us to become like a flower and to have to play our role in creation that God made us to fulfill. And then we go in that direction.
I just want to ask a question about point B. It is kind. Are there times when you have to say something even if it isn't kind? And if so, what does that mean?
I think I said the other day that parents have a somewhat gray area in there, a very special gray area for parents, where a parent sometimes needs to say something even though it isn't kind. I can see that that's possible because it would be hurtful but necessary for the safety of the person concerned, the child, whoever. I can see that. But for most of us who are not in a parental role, most of the time that we're being unkind is simply, it's sheer mischief. It's not, sometimes it's for our own entertainment, unfortunately. So, no, I can see that as a parent there would be some time. And a parent or quasi-parental role, that might also be true. Yeah.
I just wanted to share that when you talk about flowers, I think about the clothing of flowers, how beautiful they are. But I wanted to share, Victor always told me that flowers are like the prelude of heaven. And I love that mm-hmm. about flowers.
Has the Western culture influenced our inability to achieve a silence? Because I know that in many indigenous cultures, silence is a big part of, I mean, it's just a natural part of their everyday life.
Absolutely.
And those of us who border both worlds find a struggle in communicating with elders because they sometimes take too long right. to answer a question. And we want to fill the space.
Right.
So has Western culture, what I mean by that is contact with Europeans and all of that has developed since then. How much does that influence that?
I think you make a very, very valid point. And although my experience is limited, there are many cultures around, including indigenous cultures in this country and elsewhere, where silence is in fact a part of the cultural norm. Our problem is, for us, it's a cultural, what do you call it?
Rarity.
It's almost a cultural misdemeanor.
Felony.
Got to fill the silence. And yet, no, I lived in Montana for a while and I encountered it there. I've encountered it to a certain extent amongst like the Hmong people from Vietnam, Laos, and some other people that I've worked with, where silence is a part of the culture. The trouble is you can go to somewhere, you know, you can go to anywhere in the world and hear silence being torn to shreds by noise. Tatiana, the icon painter, I don't think you were here yesterday, I was talking about Tatiana, an icon painter who lives in Santa Cruz. And she's a very artistic person, but she is able to listen to public radio when it's only barely tuned in to the station. So it's on the edge, you know. I can't do it even for a second. I mean, I get completely spare. She is quite capable, a very artistic, very spiritual person in her own way. But she's quite capable of listening to this ear-jarring noise. Amazing. Thank goodness we're all different.
There is in the Western region, now the Western Diocese, a parish that has a silent retreat once a month. And that's St. Michael's in Whittier. A few years ago, I spoke to the women in the community, not of that parish, but of the region, and I asked them at lunchtime to have a silent lunch. And I can't do this sitting down. And you would have thought I asked them to undress. They were just aghast at that suggestion. So I said, we'll compromise. I said, for the first half hour of the lunch, be silent. Don't speak. Just eat. In the second half hour, you may speak. So I was true to that. Half hour came up. I said, now you may speak. I said, but I have a question for you at the end of the half hour. The question was, what did you hear God saying to you while you were talking? So there is a tradition. It's wavy and it's frail in our Orthodox Church of having true retreats. Unfortunately, the language that the Byzantine uses is they use the word retreat when they really mean a conference,
right.
A chatty, right. Learned conference.
Right.
Retreat is when you're silent,
mm-hmm.
and you may have a reader reading to you part of that time, but most of the time you're on your own with God.
And rather important, I mean, my work in mental health, and I believe your own work in mental health, is most people in the end are terrified about meeting themselves. And yet when you go into silence, there is bound to be a certain element which you confront yourself. And for some people, that's just too frightening.
I'm thinking about a remark you made on chant being sung silence. And it seems to me the whole liturgy is a kind of silence. It was one of the things that's so striking to me about Orthodox liturgy. We do not have a committee to plan that. Well, last week, to shake things up, we'll have a parade in the middle of the liturgy. Or this week, we've been doing that certain thing so often, everybody's bored to tears. We will have, we'll have a little tap dancing. And so, I mean, there are churches that have...
Next Sunday, I want you all to bring your grandfather clocks. Yeah. And we'll have a grandfather clock Sunday. Yeah.
You know, what we do over and over and over and over again. And at the beginning, of course, it takes quite some getting used to. But eventually, unless we're children and we grow up in it. But eventually, it does become...
Right. It's using it in a very, let's face it, a rather unusual way. And I wouldn't advise people to start learning about silence there. That's sort of like, you know, silence 501. Yes.
I'd like to make a comment. When I was first married, I was amazed that a group of men could be sitting in our house not saying anything. And I was uncomfortable with that. Secondly, when Al was talking, what came to my mind was that a vehicle of achievement to being in the heart is love. And I want your comment on that. A vehicle to achieving the heart, the being in the heart, no, what do you call it? The arrival of the heart is love. That's one of the vehicles.
I was saving up something somewhat profound to say about love tomorrow. And I think I'll do just that, if you don't mind. What you say is very beautiful, but there's a whole area there. It's somewhat, and I want to be able to present it in the right way, in the right order. And so, if you don't mind, could we hold that one for tomorrow? Thank you. We could, of course, sit here in silence. That would be just fine. But if you want to break the silence, you may.
Father, I was wondering, and I may have missed it, but we've talked a bit about mind, and that was wonderful, and also about soul. But how about spirit? I'm just curious, the differentiation between soul and spirit, is that something we're headed for? I'm feeling the need to know the difference in the context of what you're speaking.
As I said, I can't remember which day it was. I'm not very good at that. Let me read you a piece that I wrote. This is coming out in, if any of you get the magazine called The Divine Ascent, but from Father Joseph, Father Jonas Monastery, this essay is coming out in it. I think it's here somewhere. And let me, because I've written this once, you might as well get the gist of it. It's under completed writing projects. There we go. I'm so disorganized. Now, I can never remember. In Word, if it says, do you want to revert, you have to say, is it yes or no? I can never remember. Do you want to revert? Do you want to revert? Because one way you lose it. I know you lose it. Say no. If in doubt, say no. Let's see if... I think I don't have to worry about that. I'm going to move that. I'll worry about that later on. What was the question?
I was
spirit, right. Oh, I'm going to have to say no. Okay. So, oh, it didn't disappear. Okay. We're in luck. The article starts like this. I admit that I have a problem. Since I was very little, I've been told that I have a soul. Obviously, a soul is not something you can observe or touch, like hands or feet. But that never worried me very much, since it is also true that I have a heart and a stomach, even though I'm not absolutely sure where they are, unless I look them up in a book. Unfortunately, there is no book I can look at to tell me where my soul is. The same is true with regard to spirit. If I have a soul and a spirit, how are they different from each other? I'm not obviously aware of either one, and I'm less aware of the difference between the two. What I am aware of within myself is a mind, with its constant stream of comments and instructions, and a body through which emotions are felt. And I went on to say that Bishop Callistos, in at least two of his books, there's an academic for you, I have no idea where it was, said, you know, a lot of fathers use the tripartite body, mind, and spirit. Personally, and I'm a dead loss, but personally, I can't cope with body, mind, and spirit. It's too complicated. What is the difference between the two? I don't know. So I don't. So what, for the sake of these 3 days, 4 days, I'm simplifying. I know I'm simplifying what we have available, but I'm simply saying thoughts, logis, me, mind, soul, heart, and nous, body. And that's for the sake of what we've done, that's how I've had to do it. So my answer was terrible. But that's the one you've got. So.
It was very apathetic.
Yes. Actually, it was quite cataphatic. It is terrible. Yes. Apophatic is when you describe things in negative terms. Cataphatic is when you describe things in positive terms. But the odd thing is, philosophically, and if there's a professional philosopher in the house, I'm sorry about this, but the odd thing is, if you say something positive about something, it makes that thing smaller than if you say something negative about that same thing. Oh, don't ask me. It's very difficult to. It's to do with limiting. If you make a negative statement about something, you haven't limited the thing at all, no matter what it is. If you make a positive statement, like God is great, you've now put God in this word called great. You've limited him.
I'm coming on that because this goes back to my son. And that's very encouraging because he refuses to put limits around God. Even when I say God exists, he won't put a limit there.
Good for him.
And he has he's real interested in philosophy. Not that I'm not trying to take credit from his smartness. That anyway, I feel good about that.
You never knew when you came tonight. Yeah, you never knew. I mean, from the Orthodox point of view, we always have to ask the question: do you really mean God can fit into this piece of bread? And the answer has to be yes. Because he chooses to. That's for the Orthodox. Sorry.
Sure. Father, typically do people find it very helpful on this path if they spend some time at a monastery? And is there any minimal time that's helpful for most of us that it would be kind of a short rear visit?
St. Theophan the Recluse, who had some extraordinarily wonderful things to say, I'll be quoting from him tomorrow at one point, but nevertheless was a very, very, very Victorian Russian. Was very adamant that you do not have to go into a monastery to learn this stuff. And in fact, to assume that you have to be somewhere else at another point in time to do this is the crucial mistake that we all want to make. You remember, anywhere but here, anytime but now. When I go to the monastery, it will be fine. When I've graduated with my cum laude, it will be fine. When I've got married, when I have children. So every time we do that, and we do it for a million and one different reasons, any time we do it which is not in the now, then we're putting it off in some way. Going to a monastery is a good thing to do if you want to go to a monastery. And if, by all means. But to do this particular work, this work needs to be done, or can be done, by everybody everywhere. It's like that, some of the early fathers literally ran off into the desert. And it wasn't a desert, like it wasn't like that Saudi Arabian desert that with nice clean lines and sand that, you know, and this, and somebody delivering, you know, your bread and milk each morning. It was the Palestinian desert and the Egyptian desert is dirty. It's cold. It's at night. It's cold during the winter. Very cold. I've been more cold in Bethlehem than I've been anywhere else on the planet, I think. Not in the terms of the numbers, but in how you feel. They were running away from what they knew of civilization. And there is a tendency for us all to want to run away. But I have to say, in my own experience, both as an Orthodox Christian and as a member of AA, that the silence that counts is the silence that I carry around with me. And there can be any amount of jazz going on, I use that in the pejorative sense, around me. And my heart can be silent. Or there's complete silence around me and my heart can be full of jazz. So there's no guarantee. But the important thing is to have the internal silence. The internal silence, as Saint Seraphim Sarov said, you know, find peace in your heart and 1,000 people will be saved. If you find this degree of inner serenity, then but your every action will share this with the people around you. Monks and nuns don't need it as much as the rest of the world needs it. They've already got where they're going sort of thing. The rest of the world needs it very much. So if you want to go to a monastery, go to a monastery. But not specifically to do this, no. And certainly if anybody's under the impression that it's easier in a monastery to do anything, I have to tell you, it is not. It is simply different. The rules are simply different. But it's no easier at all. Some people lose their faith by going to a monastery, so be careful. Yes, sir. Well, okay.
Father, I wanted to ask, you spoke about the mind and the body, and the place of the heart was in the body, and the place of the mind was thoughts and things like that. You also spoke a minute ago about God creating an inability in himself to penetrate the mind. Is that the place that God guards for us so we have a free will?
If you develop that thought, yes. It's a little speculative, and I'm on uneasy ground here. But it does strike me as very powerfully that even the smallest child can shut God out. I mean, God is capable of creating, you know, galaxies and universe, you know, sometimes, and we can be overwhelmed by just how powerful, but I mean, unbelievable amounts of power, and yet my no can stop him. So, but that no is the safeguard. I mean, that has to be safeguarded by freedom. So you're absolutely correct. Logically, what you said is absolutely correct. Do you want to? One last.
I want to ask the same question I did last session. Why was Greek the most conducive to writing the scriptures?
That was his comment.
Yeah, but I said
that
you might answer.
Oh,
he passed it on to you, so this is what you inherited.
Oh, okay. In the time in which the life event of Jesus took place, there was an inevitability that Greek had to be used to talk about it. Even though Jesus and his disciples may not have spoken a word of Greek, may not. Some of them at least would have known some Greek, I think. Whether Jesus did or not, we have no way of telling. Greek has a very, very fine pedigree and has been around a long time. Latin has now degenerated into 5 or 6, actually, how many different language groups? Well, French and the subfamilies, Spanish, Portuguese, Romanian, Italian, English just. Only by way of that unfortunate event in 1066. And German the same. I mean, you've got, and that's a family of about, let's say, 10 languages, and Slavonic, perhaps another 10 languages. Greek hasn't done that. Greek has gone in a straight line. This is extraordinary, why this should be, but Greek has gone in a straight line. The Greek we speak today is not the Greek that Homer spoke. Right. But it's on the same line. There's never been, you know, no branching out, no nothing. It's a direct descendant. I think I don't probably share Jim's enthusiasm for the language per se, in that it's probably the best way of communicating Christian experience. But it is, Greek has a quality of clarity, which is very useful. And because it's just one line, we can get more insight by, for example, seeing how a word was used in the 5th century AD, the 5th century BC, in order to understand a word which was written down in the 1st century AD. We have that capacity. More than that, I can't say. I really wish Jesus had spoken Dutch, but, you know, that's... I think there's some people in Friesland that believe he did, so... or a Friesian, anyway. Okay. I don't think I'm telling any tales, but I've asked Father Mark if we might meet for our session, that's to say the evening session, tomorrow upstairs. But we'll be meeting here as usual for Jim's session at 3:30. After the 3:30 session, we'll need some of you great muscular chaps to help get set up, just break, take chairs upstairs. But we'll remind you about that tomorrow, because I would really like to finish up these four talks, sharing sessions with you in the church. Thank you. Okay.